Okay, thank you, Laura, and thank you for the invitation to be here tonight. And we would really like to keep this informal. We don't have a formal presentation. We know that the developer was at your last meeting, and we trust that you've heard from United Illuminating in the past regarding the site. So we didn't prepare anything formal. Laura was very kind and sent us some questions, and we're prepared to go through those. I would like to introduce myself. So I'm the Deputy Commissioner for Environmental Quality, which means I'm responsible for our air, waste, and water bureaus. So all of those programs that regulate environmental issues in the state, which complements our other two branches in the department, including the Environmental Conservation Branch, which is natural resources and outdoor recreation, and our energy branch. And with me tonight is Peter Zack. Peter is the Director of the Emergency Response and Spill Prevention Division, and Gary Trombley, who is a supervisor in that division. Gary and Peter have been working on English Station for a very long time. And the reason the remediation of English Station is located within the Emergency Response and Spill Prevention Division is that that's where our PCB program is located. And I think, as all of you know, PCBs are a major driver in terms of the English Station remediation. And I don't think it's necessary for us to go through the history of how we ended up where we are today on English Station. But I think everyone knows that we have a partial consent order that's in place with United Illuminating. There is also an order that is in place with the property owner. And we have been actively working with United Illuminating on both investigation and planning for remediation of the English Station property. There's two parcels associated with it, parcel A and parcel B. I thought we'd go straight into the questions, Laura, if that will work. And Gary and Peter are especially well positioned to answer them, especially for some of the details. So I will turn it over to them. Does that sound like a good approach? Okay. So the first question is, and I think this goes to the overall schedule associated with remediation. And there is a schedule that's in the existing partial consent order, and clearly the schedule has slipped. Gary, do you want to respond to that one in particular?
Yeah, Betsy, I'll take that one. So originally the schedule was pretty aggressive. It was a 3-year schedule. And during development of the schedule, it was noted that some of the information as we were gathering during investigation was going to cause it to slip a little bit. I think one of the biggest reasons that the schedule's been protracted is the fate of the main power plant building is still unknown, and the investigation continues within that building. So, without a clear understanding of what is the big structure upon parcel B, a schedule is very difficult for to be developed, especially given that our ongoing investigations continue. There's a lot of work that's occurring inside that building. A variety of scopes of work have been approved, but there's still more work to be done, and the schedule has been difficult to pin down because of the extensive investigations that are occurring within that building.
Yeah, I'll just add that, once the building issues have been decided, then it makes sense to go forward with any of the soil and the smaller buildings surrounding the large power plant and the other parcel. So that's what's kind of been held up in the schedule.
And I think just in terms of we have good characterization on parcel A, correct, Gary, and a remedial action plan that is ready to be implemented on parcel A. We're still working with some very specific details associated with the property owner as it relates to that. But United Illuminating is saying that they want to remediate parcel B and parcel A at the same time. And a lot of that is related to the fate of the power plant building. And your question, Laura, about a lack of updates, are you talking about new schedules being put in? Was that specifically what you were thinking about? Okay. And I think Gary's answer pretty much addressed that. So when we enter an order or a stipulated judgment with, someone. There are initial dates based on our best guess, but we continue to not actually modify the order, but work with the respondent and try to keep the pressure on to make sure that they are moving forward and addressing things. As you can imagine, there's a lot of technical details associated with this property and a lot of work that has been done. We have ongoing coordination meetings with UI monthly, Gary, is that correct?
That is correct.
The dialogue is very, very active. The second question that Laura posed is, are there penalties for UI or the English Station owners for not completing the remediation on schedule? So in order for there to be penalties, they would have had to be built into the PCO or any order that was issued. And those orders did not. It's not typical that we would include stipulated penalties in a remediation order of this nature. So they're not built in. If we got to a point where we thought that such stipulated penalties were necessary or penalties were available, it would probably be either a new order or potentially a court action. And we really are trying to work cooperatively with both UI and with the property owner, because I think we all share the same interest, which is getting the site remediated and back to productive reuse.
So if there are no penalties, there's not such a big incentive to get it done, is there? What's the incentive?
So both Peter, Gary, and I have spent a lot of time working with property owners and trying to get sites remediated. Remedial costs continue to escalate. It's not in UI's interest to let this drag on forever. They really would like to get this liability off their books if they're like any other corporation. I think there are incentives. I don't know whether Peter or Gary would like to add to that.
No, I don't think I have anything else to add to that. That's not really an issue. It's just the complexity between the owner, UI, and just the complexities of the station that's been holding things up.
Right. So this is a bit unusual in that you have a responsible party, United Illuminating, who doesn't actually have full control of the property as the property owner. A lot of times when we're working on remediation, both the entity remediating the property and the property owner are one and the same. And that's not the case here. So there's sort of three parties that are involved in all of these discussions, even though United Illuminating is fundamentally responsible for the remediation. Kathy has her hand up.
I wondered whether that is typical for with any property when you're working on remediation. Is it typical to not include stipulations of penalties?
Yes, it is fairly typical for remediation type projects.
Thank you. That was it.
Laura, you're on mute.
Iris posted a question in the chat. She wants to know some examples of what's going on in the building, what sort of problems.
I just want to get a general idea, because you want to start first at the building, then at the site on one hand, and the other hand, UI wants to do the remediation all at once. So I don't have any idea what kind of issues or problems are in the building. And that's the first question.
Gary, do you want to respond to that?
Just an example, or give us a sense of the complexity.
So you've got, we'll start at the floor. The floor is different chemicals of constituents all over the place in different areas within the building. So we have to evaluate concrete, trenches, discharge tunnels. The building is quite large. That is just the floor. I'm going to keep this fairly simple to give you a general idea. I don't want to get into too much technical detail. Also, what you should be aware of is there's a main floor 8 feet of what's called interstitial fill, which is soil. Then there's what's called a mat on the bottom. So they're investigating the soil beneath the main floor to the mat. So that's also, you know, comprehensive. And we've had a couple of, you know, scopes of work we've approved. Then we've had some interaction about additional data gathering. So that's an ongoing iterative process that happens at every site. But what is very unique is that in one of the boiler areas, they're going to be doing some remedial, interim remedial action to remove some contaminated soil in the interstitial fill space between the floor and the mat to get to the mat to sample the mat that's down 8 to 12 feet. So that's ongoing within the building. We haven't got a scope of study for that just yet, but that is ongoing. That is just the first floor down. Now, you also have a structure that can be 9 feet high in some places and 6 feet, 9 stories high, 6 stories high in other areas. And you have to investigate paint, building materials, spills, tracking, all over that. So add all that square footage into not just the square footage of the building floor, but then the square footage of the building itself has to be evaluated. So it's pretty comprehensive in there. And that all that in various different phases is occurring at this moment. So there's a variety of different work scopes going on different portions of the building in different media within the building upon different floors within the building.
Did that answer your question, Iris?
Yeah, I'm getting a sense of the complexity. And the schedule can't be defined. Is that correct? That you don't have, do you have a tentative schedule or an
We don't really have a tentative schedule because every time we get something in, there's usually a correspondence, there's a data gap that has to be filled in. One thing ties into another, and then you go down another path to make sure you've covered that avenue of it. So it's an iterative process that continues to develop because as remediation is formulated in this building, we're trying to limit, there will always be unknowns, but we're trying to limit the amount of unknowns once we get into this building because it's going to affect the fate of the building ultimately.
So to really address that issue, and this is sort of going off the questions that Laura addressed. So given the historic activities in the building, some of the building materials are contaminated in addition to the contamination that may or may exist in this interstitial fill that Gary talked about and the flooring. So there are, if the building is to stay up, all of that has to be decontaminated. And there are a variety of ways to do that. There's also an ongoing discussion between United Illuminating and the department as to what standard that building material needs to be remediated to. And the simplest way to think about it is either to a low occupancy standard, which is what UI believes they need to remediate, or a high occupancy standard. And this is driven by federal rules in terms of the definition of those two terms. And ultimately, what the building, if it stays up, can be used for will be determined in part by whether it's high occupancy standards or low occupancy standards. Okay.
Kathy?
So my understanding is that the owner is interested in having it end up being a mixed use site, which is, am I correct in assuming that mixed use would mean high occupancy standard?
Assuming that mixed use means commercial and residential, the site would need to be cleaned up to what we call residential criteria. It's a little complicated though. When we say residential criteria, what we're talking about in general are the soil conditions on the site and that they're suitable for residential use. The use of the building is distinct from what the soil cleanup criteria is.
That makes sense. So then this is kind of conjecture, but do you see, I have trouble imagining that this site could ever be used for residential, that the remediation cost would be prohibitive. So,
let's not talk about that at this meeting. Let's get through environmental concerns and see if we can't get the site cleaned up first before we go into what's going to happen to it next, because I'm extremely concerned about the current state, if that's okay. I know we have concerns about other things. Okay. Well,
and Laura, let's talk a little bit about the current state, because some of your questions are, has the soil on the site been characterized? And I'll throw that question to Gary, along with questions about, originally there were some discharges that were going into the river from the site, and Gary can address the fate of those discharges also.
So okay. The soil on the site has been investigated and deemed complete. And I will give you a little caveat to that, though. The soil in most of the materials on this site are federally regulated, as Betsy had mentioned. You have a federal component here. Within the federal rule, you don't have to complete the investigation to ND. You can complete
ND,
the investigation.
ND meaning non-detected
concentrations of PCBs. So in this case, there's areas that are not defined. In other words, vertical and horizontal extent are not necessarily defined, but will be defined and can be defined under the federal rule of approval during verification sampling. So it is with that knowledge that the investigation of soil was deemed complete. A lot of the other constituents of concern will be addressed during the removal of the PCBs, because as you know, the PCBs are the driver at the site. The hot areas that are like metals and other things are co-located with PCBs. So that will take care of some of the other constituents pretty much in the remedial action plan, even though there's a separate remedial action plan. So the soil work is done. They have a little bit more to do in some localized areas that's not exactly part of the PCB.
Had 9 babies.
Wow.
They were expecting 7.
Is that a question or is that?
No.
Oh, okay. All right. And the outfalls, I'm glad this question was brought up because the public brought this up. And this is a very important thing, the interaction of the public to the agency. And I'd like to say thank you for that, because we are not at the site all the time. And this was brought up and addressed with UI. Originally, the outfall that was identified, UI had said that it was from tidal water flowing out of the pipes after high tide. We discovered that is not necessarily the case. We interfaced with UI and had an extensive discussion about this. We had them sample the outfall. We have those lab results, which I understand that you are interested in, and we will certainly get those off to you. And it indicated that there were some constituents of concern in the pipe. So we requested that they go sample other outfalls and identify all other outfalls around the island. They found 17 outfalls. They could not collect samples from the other outfalls as they were not actively running. So the agency instructed UI seal them all. And all 17 have been sealed. That occurred in December of 2020. We had them reinspect those seals in February 2021. And we also have that information. So those 17 outfalls have been sealed by UI.
And Gary, a question in the chat is, why did it take a year from notification to actually sealing of the outfalls?
That's a great question. There was a discussion with UI about what their obligations were in their activities, whether they contributed to what was occurring and whether they were obligated to seal these outfalls. They initially, after extensive discussions, they were compelled to seal those outfalls.
And what happens to the water that was going into those outfalls previously?
The outfalls would drain to the Mill River, Benson.
No, I think the point is, if they were draining something, have the inputs to those drain pipes been eliminated also is the question.
Yeah, well, they were, some of them were plugged with concrete. Others were sealed on the bulkhead with welded plates.
Okay. So then another overall question that you've asked, Laura, is obviously we're all, I'm sure everyone who's in this meeting and the department is clearly driven by not wanting there to be adverse impacts to public health from the site, and concerns about both neighbors, people who utilize the river, and all of those pieces. It's one of the reasons the department's so focused on remediating the site. The right way to address any risk that might exist is by getting the site cleaned up to appropriate standards. And also, I know that Gary and company have worked very hard with United Illuminating to make sure that trespassers are not allowed on the property. Obviously, nothing's 100%, but that's one of the most important ways to eliminate risk in terms of direct. Gary, do you want to add to that?
Well, we have a security system that's 360, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. It notifies UI of any trespassers going on the site, and then they can notify authorities as to how to remove and take care of the individuals. And in some cases in the past, they've been deconned in the street. So we haven't had any incursions onto the site for quite a few years now, and the system continues to operate. We had to do a little bit of a modification when Station B on Parcel A was taken down, as we had to relocate cameras to cover the site, but it was never down. They relocated the cameras before they deactivated the cameras in Station B. Plus the front of this Ball Island has now got a fence to prohibit access to the site from Grand Ave. Obviously a bulkhead is essentially a moat on three other sides, so that's helping as well. But we could still pick them up on camera if they came in by boat.
Okay, the next question, Laura, did you have a question?
Yes, so we're not just concerned about people trespassing onto the site. We are concerned about people living in the vicinity, going to school in the vicinity across the street from this. And I'm just worried about the existential stress of people who are facing a toxic space in their neighborhood and the ramifications of that on their health and things like that.
So, Laura, I understand that. The best way to mitigate that stress permanently is to get the site remediated, which is why we're so focused on that. It's also why the timeframe does concern us, as it clearly concerns you. I think, Gary, is direct exposure, though, in contact with the soil, the most likely direct risk from the site?
Yes, it is. You know, those areas are reported on a monthly basis. They're significant environmental hazard areas, Betsy. Okay. And so they do monitor fencing and, other issues that have been put in place and warning signs that should be up around significant environmental hazard areas located on the site. And most of those, in fact, I think all of them are on Parcel B, not on Parcel A.
And what about water from the site at high tide that mixes with water in the river? What impact is that having on people who use the river, who on the oyster farm, on people who fish, on people who boat, on people who take it upon themselves to swim in the river, things like that?
Hey, Gary, why don't you talk about the groundwater monitoring that's been done and some of those results? I think that, we use the groundwater monitoring on the island's groundwater to determine what might leave the island and go into the surrounding river. So, Gary, could you comment on that?
Yeah, the last groundwater report that I took a look at, there is no PCBs in groundwater throughout the site in the monitoring well network. There is some metals within the groundwater, and the interaction of tidal flux is minor along the edges of the outside of the island. There really is no flux in the center, and this is according to data that I'm receiving from UI's consultant. So there is movement, but it's not as great as a tidal flux in the groundwater as the tides itself. So the interaction is not as great as if you think of a tidal flux, it's not that great. I do want to point out, though, and it's fair to point out to everyone, that the bulkhead itself, though, you have to be aware it's an engineered structure and it is not watertight. And I think I just want to point that out. That's why they are monitoring groundwater on the site along the edges of the bulkhead.
The site is built on fill material too, you know, which was deposited years ago. So it's not virgin soil.
Okay, Laura, another question you'd asked was about the barge that floated away. Gary or Peter, do you want to address the status of that and future plans?
Sure, I can take that one. So the barge that floated away was secured by the Coast Guard, and DEP has found some funding to be able to salvage both the barge, both barges. I don't think that's been completed yet, but that is the plan. The funding has been secured, and there's a plan devised where to bring the barges to access them to pull them out of the water and salvage them.
Okay. Another question that Laura asked us was about a subcontractor claim. And our response on that is that would be between United Illuminating and the subcontractor, and we are not involved in those disputes if one exists. So that would be a question for United Illuminating on that issue. The next question is, we've touched on this issue already, and the issue is, to what degree will the site be remediated? Under the partial consent order, United Illuminating is required to remediate the site to industrial commercial standards, which means it would be suitable for an office building, an industrial facility, or something of that nature. I have a barking dog. I'm going to let Gary or Peter discuss the building issue and just sort of restate that issue for us.
I think that there's two things to understand here. One is beneath the building, the soil has to be cleaned to less than one for PCBs. It's a little bit different. It's not an industrial commercial cleanup. That would be around the outside of the building. Within the building itself, you know, the EPA has not weighed in as to what occupancy they would allow in a building. I think we touched on that. That's an unknown at this point. But I think it's important to understand that the soil beneath that building, as is outlined in the PCO, is to be cleaned to less than one ppm.
And then the next question.
Oh, sorry. So it was owners, the memo from the owner's attorney that claims that the United Illuminating cleanup is only going to be for occupancy up to 16.8 hours per week. I don't know if they're correct, but that's what they're claiming. And that's why they say they will not sign the complete consent order.
So that issue is specific to the building and to the power plant. And it relates to this low occupancy standard we talked about or a high occupancy standard. And I think the actual standard is 6.8 hours per week, Gary, is that correct?
6.7. You're close.
6.7.
Pretty good.
I don't even know what a 7/10 of an hour is. So, and this is where the department and United Illuminating have a disagreement about to what extent the building materials would need to be remediated. That's if the building stays up. If the building stays down or comes down, clearly that's a non-issue because that material would go offsite. It would be properly secured in the correct type of landfill and addressed that way. And that would only apply to the building, not to the soil or parcel A. Okay. Another question which often comes up is how much money is available to remediate the site? The partial consent order has a number of $30 million in it. That is not a cap. The way that works, and Peter and Gary, please correct me if I'm wrong, if the cost to remediate the property is less than $30 million, then funding would come to the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection to be used. However, all indications are that the remedial costs will exceed $30 million. So we're not anticipating that that becomes an active condition, and the PCO does not limit the remediation cost to $15 million. I'm sorry, to $30 million. I was reading the chat. So, and a chat question, which is relevant to this is, and I read the chat, not taking this as UI has stated they've already spent over $15 million. They are responsible to reporting to us their expenditures. We have not audited that to see what exactly is eligible for coverage under that $30 million. Peter or Gary, anything to add there?
Well, I think, Betsy, it's important, like you said, it is not a cap, it's a floor. So if it exceeds 30 million, it exceeds 30 million and the cleanup needs to continue. Beyond that, they can appeal and try to get recovery of some of those fees, but that bridge has not been crossed yet, but they have to spend the money it takes to remediate the site per the PCO.
Gary, what have they reported to us for the total cost so far? Do you have that figure?
I think Aaron might have chatted that, and he's correct. It's about $15 million that they've spent, but Betsy put the caveat on that. Not all the costs that they're reporting may necessarily be eligible under the conditions of the PCO. Some of that cost may not be eligible, but they're reporting all their costs at this point.
Right, but I believe their costs will expend, and even eligible costs will exceed $30 million.
Yes.
Okay, a question that we get quite often is, so under the PCO and under our regulations, we can require that they remediate the soil and the site to commercial industrial standards. And those standards are specified in our remediation standard regulations and are what we can hold United Illuminating to. Obviously, the site could be remediated to residential standards. There are a couple of different ways to approach that, but a very interesting question is, what's the cost delta between what would be required for industrial, commercial, and what would be required from residential? We don't have a cost estimate for that. There would be some different approaches. One would be taking soil out. One would be bringing soil in if you could justify an appropriate institutional control. So we don't have a firm estimate on that. I know that the developer has expressed to us that as part of the mixed use, they'd like to see the site remediated to residential standards. We also know that they have hired consultants to look at that issue, but we haven't seen any cost numbers associated with that.
If I could ask a question, you said appropriate institutional control. What does that phrase mean?
So that is a term out of the the remediation standard regulations, Giovanni. And say, for example, and Gary can probably speak to this much better on this site than I can. If they were to put in an engineered control or a cap, for example, that would be an example of an institutional control. And it would come with long-term maintenance and management. Gary, do you want to add to that?
No, that would be appropriate. That would be one of the outlets that they could take, and probably the most likely one if they had to, design something to go to residential, unless they dug it out to less than one, which we don't have a cost on that, and it could be pretty high. So in some cases like that, yes, they'll use an engineer control with monitoring and financial assurance mechanisms.
Right. And the site presents some challenges for that because of the bulkhead, and typically they'd want to raise the grade rather than dig out, as Gary said, and bring back in clean fill. But that would be an example of an institutional control. One of the questions that Laura asked also is, would it be possible for EPA to come to evaluate the site? We can assure you that we've been actively working with our EPA colleagues, specifically within the PCB program. Gary, do you want to speak to Kim Tisa's role and our interactions with her?
Kim Tisa is the PCB coordinator for Region 1 for the US EPA, and that would cover Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, Rhode Island, and Connecticut, the whole region. She has been to the site. She has walked the site. She has been involved with the location prior to the current owners. So she was involved in approving plans back when the site moved from UI to Quinnipiac Energy. Of course, she had to reissue her approval on Parcel A because we have new owners. So she is aware of what is occurring at the site. She's involved in a lot of the aspects of the site, as this is a federally regulated location. And I have frequent calls with her on other sites as well as this site. So the interaction is constant and ongoing, and she is actively involved at this location. And on top of it, has been to this site.
And I think the last formal question Laura gave us is, would a peer review of the site and the remediation be appropriate? And I'm not so sure we really understood that question. I think from our perspective as the regulator, we see our responsibility as to do a thorough technical review of any information that is put together and any plans or remedial action plans that UI puts in front of us. Gary is the lead on doing that, working with Peter Zach and Lori Salaby and other people on our team. And we really fundamentally see that as our role. And we obviously work with EPA when necessary and where appropriate. So I'm not really quite sure what you guys were thinking about in terms of peer review. I think we also know that the developer is hiring consultants who are also looking at the work that is going on at UI. And Iris posted, what's the name of the PCB coordinator at Region 1? It is Kim, and our last name is Tisa, T-I-S-A. So I've been trying to watch the questions in the chat. I think we addressed most of them through that process. If there are specific ones, the one that we didn't address was about SHPO. And the question is, can answers, it would actually be helpful if you ask your question directly, because I'm not so sure I really understand the question.
Yeah, you know, it's been a long time since we all talked. I think it was March last year that we had a big meeting with many of the local advocates here and a lot of your staff. And at that time, we brought this up, and it is very related to the questions about cleanup methods and levels. Because as you say, we still don't know enough about the building to know if it's feasible and viable to maintain it. And I think many people know I've, you know, very strongly advocated that we really try to do both, preserve the building and clean up the site to the highest level that's viable. So how this relates to it, when you mentioned that there is ongoing work and various, I think you didn't call them work orders, but different like packets of decisions. Maybe you could tell me again what you call that, where you've approved certain work, let's say, on what Gary is calling the map area, or a tunnel, or spillage on floors, that one of the things that you'd need to consider is whether it could undermine the structure. In my work, I've seen a lot of situations where something will happen where they say they're going in to test something in terms of engineering, and a beam will be pulled out, and then they claim the building has to come down. So there's an engineer that we've talked to in New York that has worked on buildings like this where, you know, giant sections of concrete and brick walls will need to be excised, and then a process is put into place of putting new material back in, a little bit like what you do with the soil. And that keeps the building stabilized. So how are you evaluating questions like that? And I bring up the chapeau because they would be a kind of a logical entity here to work with, just like you work with EPA.
So I want to restate what I believe your question is. When we are reviewing both investigation plans and any remedial activities, the question is, how are we ensuring that in undertaking those activities that they are not adversely impacting the building or potentially threatening its long-term viability? Is that correct?
Yes, you have stated it much simpler and clearer than I. And Kathy Fay asked who I meant by we. And I'm with the New Haven Urban Design League, and we have a kind of soup to nuts approach to the built environment in the city.
So we are not structural engineers, but I will turn that over to Gary for a direct response.
So currently this, I think what you're referencing are scopes of study interest. And during the phases of the approach of the floor, some of the floor locations are in the middle of the building. I'm not a structural engineer, but I'm going to rely on TRC in order to access and evaluate the building. They're going to have to remove sections of the floor to get to what they need to in order to find out if the building, you know, what the concentrations of the soil are beneath the building. I think what's more pertinent here is, say, walls and structures that have PCB paint in them.
Yeah.
Some of the concerns you may have are evaluating those kind of structures and how, you know, we can try not to damage the building per se. But I would say that we do have to sample some brick and substrate on the walls in order to evaluate, and this is part of an evaluation of PCBs and building materials, in order to evaluate whether the paint has leached into the bricking and the porous surfaces. That is part of the investigation. Now, there is a way to try to limit that. We have done this at other sites in which we have not harmed the building or caused it to come down. Usually those kind of decisions are made after the data comes in and it says, hey, the building is extensively impacted and it might have to be taken down because of that. We don't try to go out and do an investigation that's going to harm the structural integrity of a building by any means. In our biggest concern is health and safety. You know, I understand in your concerns with the building itself, but we certainly don't want to have anything happen that could injure anybody, the public, the workers, anything like that. So we do take that into account.
Yeah. Gary, I think it's good to point out at this point too that we did have the state historic preservation officers there. You and I were with them as they went through the building with UI. That's what SHPO stands for. And they were doing an evaluation of the building. They went through, I got to see from top to bottom everything there during that walkthrough. And it was described to them the activities that you're just mentioning about sampling, you know, the surfaces and the brick. We also talked about, you know, digging the digging into the mat or down to the mat and those type of things. And they took that into account. So yeah, we don't anticipate at least the activities that we're doing and are approved so far would compromise the structure of the building, basically, in essence. Yeah. And Gary, maybe you can, you know, more, you can describe better what SHPO, the outcome of their evaluation was.
Well, it's my recall. Thanks for reminding me of that, Pete. It's my recall that at that particular point, they didn't have a concern with the sampling techniques that were being employed. As they had seen some of these at other buildings that, you know, have a historical, you know, preservation component to them, it wasn't a destructive means what we were doing. I mean, we aren't taking concrete samples, but it wasn't destructive to the extent that it was going to affect the historical preservation of the structure.
Yeah, they took photos, and they did request that UI inform them, you know, keep them informed of any kind of other activities that would go on, you know, in the future.
When was that? When was the last walkthrough that you had with Chapeau?
Gary, well, that was more than a year ago, right? It was.
I'm going to say 2 years ago, Pete. Maybe
almost, yeah.
So perhaps there is a written record, a written document with the photos and whatever from Chapeau, and maybe Anstris, you could ask them for that if you want to.
That sounds. This all sounds. Very good. Thank you.
Okay. You're welcome. Thank you. Okay. Iris, hit it.
So I just want to repeat a couple.
You're on mute.
I want to repeat a couple questions. Kathy Fay and Laura posed concerns about the impact, the health impacts to the neighbors. And if it wasn't a money constraint, wouldn't we just want to achieve the highest level of remediation? I don't know if you do any air quality checks in the neighborhood, if the PCBs are volatile, and if they, how far they could get from English Station. Is anybody checking that? And if we look at long-term, like 20 years, I mean, short long-term, right? 20 years is not a lot, but for the city, you know, why it's in the heart of the city. It's a beautiful area. Why would we want to compromise and do commercial and industrial remediation when, you know, you're putting so much work into this, so many experts, and we want to do it once and achieve and get a good, you know, have a good job done that we, you know, there are other cities that built things over contaminated areas, and this is really the heart, a beautiful area in New Haven, and New Haven is not huge. So yes.
So Iris, I certainly understand what you said and your interest in that. In terms of under existing law, what the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection can hold United Illuminating to is reaching an industrial commercial standard. If the developer or the city would like to either work with UI or remediate the property to a higher level, we would certainly welcome that and work with whoever wanted to do that to achieve that higher level. The assumption on industrial commercial is that the standards have been set so that people who access that site would be safe with that level. In terms of air monitoring and the PCBs potentially leaving the site, Gary, do you want to address that issue?
Yeah, Betsy, that's a great question. And many PCB locations that undergo remediation, there is a requirement, especially through EPA, will require it as part of their approval. And I'm speaking for them, but I have seen it in other projects, in which there will be monitoring that occurs during remediation in order to document that everything's remaining on the site. I suspect remediation itself hasn't begun on parcel A, even though it's approved, and when parcel B goes along or the ultimate fate of the building is, there'll be a robust air monitoring plan just for that purpose. We are aware of the surrounding residents, the school, and the concerns that the public will have with that. That would be nothing new, and that has occurred at many of the projects like this. There will be an air monitoring plan, and there will be a shutdown in place if they get numbers that exceed a given requirement, and they will have to then implement a plan to stop that if there is one. UI will have to develop that, present that to the agency.
But Gary, in its passive state, volatilization and air monitoring is not necessary. Is that correct?
It is not. I think it's important to point out that some of the complaints earlier on that I heard or read in the file about this was an asbestos complaints about broken windows and asbestos. I think I want to bring up that part of the remedy that occurred out at the site by DECTAM was they removed all the friable asbestos within that building and wrapped all the stuff that is not friable to prevent it from being friable. That was the concern earlier on that I read through the file. As for PCBs themselves, there is not a concern at this particular point. It's more when you start moving them around like friable asbestos and it starts moving within the air or in very confined spaces, high concentrations within a room you may be in, not necessarily in the neighborhood per se.
Right. Which is why keeping trespassers off the site is so important.
Yeah.
And why we've really focused on that.
Yeah, and the way it can get mobilized during remediation is when you're disturbing the soil or the building materials, it could be airborne through dust particles. So that's the difference between the passive and then if you're doing something active at the site, you could change that. So that's when you step up the monitoring.
So currently with storms and winds, this is not a concern at the moment for the neighborhood around. And I mean, because we talked about a schedule, and we understand that we cannot the schedule can't move forward without doing the survey of the building. So we cannot. So for now, we're not supposed to be worried about health of the environment of the neighborhood around that the English station because it's passive and it's not disrupted. Is that correct?
Right. It's more of a direct exposure issue. And with the property secured and people not coming in contact or direct contact with it, touching the soil, touching the surfaces in the building, it's not deemed an issue right now to the surrounding areas.
Okay. I hope that answers your question, Iris.
Well, I don't know enough about this. The one reference that I looked into said that PCBs could, they could travel, and I did not delve into, I don't know. So I trust that you know what you're doing, and I'm, yeah.
Okay, so we're almost up to 1 hour. Thank you very much for joining us. We know we've taken an hour of the time of all three of you. And I'm wondering what we can do to help move this process along, if anything, and how we can continue to work in joint forces.
So Laura, I can assure you, we are trying to move the project along as quickly as we can. I don't know whether you've had an opportunity to directly speak to United Illuminating and the project managers for the project. I would certainly encourage you to do that. And if you're not satisfied with the pace, to also share that with them. We will certainly take that back.
We invited them to come to a meeting and they declined and sent a written report instead.
Okay.
Yeah, can I address that too, Laura?
Go ahead, Aaron.
Yeah, so we really appreciate your being here, Betsy and Gary and Peter. It's very helpful to be able to hear from you, especially for those of us who've been concerned about English Station for two decades and have nightmares about bad things happening with it. And it is very much in contrast to what UI has been doing, which is, I think, stonewalling would probably be a polite term. It's very useful to actually be able to hear, not just from UI, but directly from the LEPs who are working at the site. And we have not had that opportunity because they have not held a public information session of any kind since 2019. On their website, they claim that there was a public information session in March 2020, and that is completely incorrect. That was something.
No, that's they were mistaken. They took that off the website. It's not there. We discussed it with them.
It was on the website, and it didn't happen. And there are apparently no concrete plans for another information session where we can actually interrogate their LEPs who are working on site. The next one on their website, it says it's TBD or something like that. So. I understand this is not something that's addressed directly in the PCO, but it's very problematic from the perspective of the community. So we've been trying to get that message across to UI. I know that EAC, that was in the letter that the EAC sent to UI, and we hope that you can, that Deep can take that message back to UI as well. And Gary, you know, my
have we seen the EAC letter to UI? I don't think I have. If I have, I've missed it. I would love to have a copy of that.
Yeah, I would. Aaron, could you and EAC reissue that, please, just so we have a timestamp?
I don't remember what letter you're talking about, Aaron. We sent a list of questions to UI. Is that what you mean? Aaron?
Well, as a non-EAC member, I thought that Kathy had drafted a letter that was sent to UI and also to PIRA.
No, we decided to hold off on that because of because we were inviting UI to meet with us, and then they declined.
Okay, I trust Gary will take this back and share what we heard at this meeting and share that with UI. I will say that all of the documents that we receive are public information, and you are welcome to copies of those or to access that information. A lot of it is very technical, and I understand that as lay people, it can be difficult to digest. We're glad to answer any questions that you might have. And we can certainly encourage UI to hold another public meeting as part of the ongoing activities.
Okay, so I don't know if you have time to answer two more questions, but Anstris asks if Deep can discuss studies of the Mill River and how cleanup of the river relates to the English Station site. And Lynn Bonnet asks, who's making decisions about the fate of the building? Is it UI and the owner? And if you don't have time to answer that now, if you want to answer it.
I will take the last one, which is the fate of the building. It is up to United Illuminating to propose a remedy to the department in terms of addressing building materials and contamination within the building. They can do that by remediating the building materials or taking the materials down. So that is fundamentally in UI's hand. In terms of the studies of the Mill River, Peter or Gary, would you like to answer that?
You want that, Peter, one, Gary?
You want to take that, or you want me to take that one?
Yeah, go ahead. I'll chime in if I have to.
So the Mill, as everybody knows, the PCO is called the PCO because it's focusing specifically on Ball Island. The Mill River is tied up in court because they appealed it. And so it is still in the court system right now. There is data, I believe, that UI is collecting, may have collected in the Mill River already, but it may be related to the coal tar salt pile site across the way. And there's also information that's forthcoming as we've had a study at UConn has been doing some work at another site in Bridgeport, and as well as the Mill River itself. And that data is, the project is still ongoing.
I'm hoping that responded to that question.
Okay, Aaron Good says he would like to be an intervener in the Deep administrative hearing process. And Kathy, this is the last question, and then we're done with this.
Okay, this is just a follow-up question regarding the river, and that is understanding that this is still working its way through the courts. Supposing that UI is not found to be responsible, then who would be responsible for a cleanup of the river?
So the property owner can always be responsible for contamination that's on or emanating from a property. But if there was a finding that United Illuminating as the entity that operated the plant wasn't responsible, that would probably make a hard finding Also, I do want to address Aaron's issue. There is no proceeding at this point in time. When there is such a proceeding, that would be the correct time to ask for intervention if it was that type of proceeding. So I just want to be responsive to that. Gary or Peter, do you want to address that further? Not the proceeding issue, but the resultable party issue.
Well, obviously, when the data has to be gathered, it's a complicated system of collection. You know, in cases like this, there are a lot of different sources that come up, and it comes down to, at some point, the data, is there apportionment? Are there other sources? And that is why it becomes complicated in determining who is responsible for what occurs with the river. I would just deal with it from a UI standpoint that we'll see what the data says in the river. We work with data and then facts and findings from there as to if they're not responsible at this particular point. I don't have an answer as to who would be. I would assume that there's another contributor that they would identify and not them, and the data would show that. It all really comes down to the evaluation of the data, what it says and how it's interpreted. So that's about all I can give you. That's the best I can do.
Okay. Well, I would say we thank you so much for spending this hour with us and trying to explain all of these complicated issues to lay people who are not experts. And we appreciate your expertise. And we hope you'll keep in close touch with us. And if you want us to write letters advocating for anything in particular, we'll be happy to do it. We would like to hear more from United Illuminating on a regular basis about their remediation progress, even if they don't have a lot to report. I understand there's been a pandemic, but we can always do a Zoom meeting. And I know it's hard for them to get into a public forum and have a lot of angry neighbors yelling at them. I get that. But this has been going on a long time, and I understand that the owners are being a little bit difficult, to say the least, but I hope we're counting on you to find a way through this, and whatever we can do to help you, we will. Thank you so much, Betsy and Gary and Peter, and we really appreciate your coming. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
You are welcome, and we appreciate your interest, and please do stay in touch. This is a hard one, and we're working hard to resolve it, but it's not easy, and it's complicated by the three players. But the fact that knowing that you're interested and that many residents of the city of New Haven are interested, and the city staff clearly have consistently showed interest and have stayed in close touch with us on this issue. So we will continue to work towards a resolution. And it will be great to see ultimately the site cleaned up, which is our most important piece, and then hopefully ultimately redeveloped.
Great. That so, is what we would like.
Thank sorry we took so up much. So much time on your agenda.
No, so. This is what we had on our agenda for this evening. Great. This is very important. Thank you again.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Good. Okay. We'll see you in person soon, I hope.
That would be great.
Yeah.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks, Peter and Gary.
Take care. Thank you.
Bye. Okay, so here we are. I hope we got something out of that. I don't know that I understood half of it, but I will listen to the transcript and see if I understand any more. And I don't know. I'm hoping we will figure out some way forward. I'm hoping having this public forum will encourage the parties to work on this process. And I know that there are some other entities that will reach out to help if they can. So anyway, thank you everybody for contributing. Thank you for being so patient. Thank you for understanding that we couldn't talk about every single issue concerning this site this evening. And I hope you are a little bit satisfied.
Thank you for maintaining order.
Well, Laura, this was a really great, helpful meeting. I think we touched on a whole menu of important things. You know, obviously we're waiting for ongoing results. And I think that the thing that I have the least amount of clarity on is that very last topic of the relationship of Ball Island to the river, mm-hmm. and the other functions that, you know, the coal piles, the gas plant, the whole, that whole mixture of things and how that could relate to cleanup of the river. And they are clearly in the middle of studying this now. They mentioned the Yukon. We know their own investigators have been out on the river, different areas there. That would be something I'd like to learn more about.
Yeah. And I want to chime in with that it sounded to me like reading between the lines that you are just trying to find a way to say that some other entity is responsible, some entity that doesn't, you know, from our industrial past that doesn't exist anymore. And that's why I raised the question of, you know, if UI is found to not be responsible, then, you know, then what? Because
EPA has funds for orphan sites. So let's cross that bridge when we come to it. But let's at least make UI clean up whatever they've already basically agreed to clean up, because it's clear they haven't even cleaned that up. I don't know if you glanced through the EAC to whom I sent the March report that Kevin so kindly procured from DEEP. But if you saw the report from UI to DEEP, you will note that not much of the money they've already spent, which is more than $15 million, went to actual site remediation. A lot of it went to things like testing and, you know, surveying and inspecting and, yeah. So we need to get the work done, not just the supervisors filling out paperwork.
But I have to say that the testing, you know, even on residential buildings, that kind of testing is extremely expensive.
But $15 million is a lot of money to have spent on this and not really seem to have gotten very far in the remediation.
I think that Aaron pointed out, Aaron, you can tell us that some of the things that he had seen in the budgets or what they were claiming as costs were even things like their website and community meetings. And so whether that's a cleanup cost or not, I think that there'll be some questions like that.
I'm sure there will. Yeah. So I also noticed that UI is not allowed to charge ratepayers, in other words, its current customers, for any of this, which of course makes it difficult because then they have to have their accountants work even harder to hide the issue. Yeah, you get it. Yes.
Yeah, I'm concerned about
Thorstein. Yeah, go ahead.
I wasn't pleased with the answers about, like you said, existential stress on people in the community, because they are not, they seemingly are not moving as quickly as they could be, which, you know, I heard what she said, but still the people who live around there or people in the contiguous area, because we had done some work over there before when I was in 2014 in social work school with the Connecticut Coalition for Environmental Justice. It was a serious issue then about the river because people were fishing in there and often that was their main catch source of food. And so if this now, you know, has been going on and it's spreading, and I'm not a scientist, but no one can tell me that the wind doesn't pick up certain particles or something and impact the environments. And so I guess I just was not pleased with some of the answers. I mean, I know like Aaron made a good point. I'd like to go out with either of y'all in an investigation that sometimes people aren't telling us everything. And I'm not calling these people that they were being dishonest. However, you know, sometimes people tell us what they want us to know. And then maybe they don't know themselves, because obviously the owners and UI, something is not 100% there. And so I just was not pleased with some of the answers, especially about the community, involving the community, and letting them know the seriousness of what that can become before it becomes. And then people, we see the, you know, after effects of people being sick from it.
And to continue on what Florestine is saying, supposing that we had another Hurricane Sandy and stuff got really disrupted, you know, like people need to know what the dangers are of the site right now.
I thought they sealed everything.
Well, I guess I just, my understanding of what does that mean when they say they sealed everything, that nothing can get out of, nothing can escape, or is so contained.
Yeah, and actually they said the opposite. They said because it's an engineered structure that there's always going to be flow in and out of the island.
Exactly.
Okay, well, you know what? They heard us. We asked the questions. They know we are on to whatever, and that if there are environmental consequences and public health consequences, we're going to hold people responsible. Whether or not we will be able to prove it is another story, but we will know, you know, we'll know to pipe up. Yes, Iris?
So I'm just wondering if the city, you know, with all the money involved, if the city should be doing an ongoing survey of the area regarding the PCBs, and if there's, you know, part of the money should go maybe to monitor right now what's going on with the PCBs.
I thought they have sensors on the property that do monitor that stuff.
Well, they didn't give us any information, and they don't. So Florestine, you just said that there was a survey from 2014. There was some work done. So if anybody checked the fish, the water, is that ongoing, and can we request them to start now to do that while they're on the site and they have all these experts?
Well, okay. So first of all, there are a lot of contaminated sites there, so you'd have a hard time proving which one was causing the contamination. And I'm turning it over to Kevin at this point. He's the expert. You're on mute.
To try to answer Iris's question, the city does not have access to the site, I don't believe. That's private property. The city could conceivably be doing monitoring off-site. You know, for example, if they wanted to do a monitor at Martinez School or, you know, some other site that's city owned that's nearby, they could do that. The question, of course, is who pays for that? And given the industrial history of Fairhaven, obviously, there are lots of contributors to pollution in Fairhaven. And figure out who's contributing what is difficult. That goes back to Kathy Fay's point about site characterization being a very expensive process.
So, of course, once you find problems, then you're opening up a can of worms that maybe, we are relying on DEEP as the experts to sign off on this right now. So I don't know if we want to go down that road. What do you think?
I just did a simple Google Scholar and found one reference. I'll read into that and see. And I'm not an expert. I'm not gonna pursue this further than, you know, reading one document. I just wanted to know if this is like an ongoing, if somebody else knows, like if this is like the city knows of this problems ongoingly, like if this is an engineering issue that somebody would know, that there would be some spillover from because we're not the first, it's not the first energy site that contaminated a neighborhood. So if it's common knowledge, on one hand, I'm really happy with Betsy's answers and her team. On the other hand, it looks like, there's a lot of stress there, you know, just to fulfill on the requirements that they need to by regulation, not to go even further that to just, you know, just what happens a mile away from English Station. So I think they're just, so that's my sense. On one hand, I trust them. On the other hand, you know, this is in the location is in the center of our city, in a center of a residential neighborhood. So
that's it. I think what Betsy said towards the end, that, you know, she's aware of all of us and everyone is. I think it's like what you hear from a lot of some of the better city officials will say to you quietly, just keep pushing us. Mm-hmm. And so I think that this, what we're doing, can, if they have to fight with these, with the owners and with UI, and we keep pushing DEEP to fulfill its public purposes, DEEP says we have this world of advocates that's paying focus, you know, minute attention on things. And we talk to them and they ask, you know, very deep questions. So sorry, you won't be able to do this. So I think that, I think she basically said that to us, was to keep pushing.
Which is what the state attorney general's office asked us when we went to them. And stress. Yes. So we will just keep, we will keep going. And so this is my feeling about the money. It is for sure going to cost more than $30 million. And the EPA is going to have to cough up some money. And they will do it. I'm sure they will do it.
So I would also want to point out the amount of time and effort that we spent on Wheeler Street. And if we spent that much time just regular, steady pushing on this, you know, I mean, we could easily spend that much time, you know, and it'll probably take a longer, you know, longer overall time span. But, you know, we didn't give up with that. And this is a much more major issue. Well, just some people. I mean, it depends on where you live. But yeah.
Kevin?
I think we could do it.
So going back to the who pays issue, under the partial consent order, the shareholders of UI are on the hook for up to $30 million in cleanup costs. And you know, as Betsy said, it very likely will be more than that. Under the order, as I recall, once you hit $30 million, UI can go back to Pura and say, we think ratepayers should pay. Now, obviously, it's an open issue as to whether they do or not. But I'm reasonably confident that once UI has spent what it thinks is $30 million, it's going to go to Pura and say, okay, time to throw the ratepayers ante up. And that obviously would be a very protracted hearing process.
Which is why I'm hoping that we can find some money from somewhere else, from the state or from EPA, and get it done that way, because we don't want a protracted years-long fight over who's going to pay. It'll cost more money for the fight than it would to pay. So let's try to make sure that doesn't happen. We will continue to push. I don't know. I mean, Anstris and I, it took a year and a half to get this meeting. Anstris and I and Kat Fiedler from Save the Sound went to the Attorney General's office in Hartford before the pandemic and met with them. And they said, get the people from DEEP to meet with you. We're just their lawyers. And then come back to us if they don't help you. So, you know, mm-hmm. we are doing what we can do. I have had, it took many communications to get DEEP to come to this meeting. And I have to tell you that someone very nice at DEEP intervened for us. That's how we got it. So I'm not going to go into who it is, but just so you know, we have people on our side at DEEP. And I've had many, many email exchanges with UI about this, and several with the owners and their attorneys, and phone calls too. So this is taking a lot of my time. We are working on it every minute. It is not out of our sight, and it stays on our agenda. And just the fact that it stays on our agenda, I hope everyone knows that that means that we are working on it even quietly. So
I'd like to say one thing related to an issue that Florestine brought up, and a few people, about in a way, what we've been calling the existential issue of the impact of all of this on the close by neighbors in particular. I was just walking down there the other day, and you know, the area just does look worse and worse and worse, and it isn't looking any better after all of this and the delays. So there's the actual worry about, are the PCBs blowing around? What's blowing around? But there's also the impact of having this degraded environment that you see every day from your classroom and all of that. Something just to leave you as a thought, if public money gets involved, whether it's federal or state, it then becomes an issue that is going to be very hard for all of us to deal with, because we know the developers have this idea of a very fancy upscale, like luxury apartments. And do you put money towards something when a developer actually has a plan that really might not be copacetic with a neighbor?
Okay, you know what, Anstris? I think that is far in the future, and we don't even have to worry about it yet. Honestly, I don't want to spend time talking about that until there's more concrete, you know, until the cleanup is farther along.
Part of EJ is the people who have suffered with it the most, they should have a voice about what it turns into. So that's, I'm putting that out there for the future. Because if people say, if the federal government throws in another $15 million, we need to be prepared to talk about that.
Okay.
And fine. I don't have an answer. I'm just want to put it out there for people to think about.
Okay.
Hopefully within some of the other processes that are happening in that community, like the Mill River Urban Waters Initiative, hopefully more and more community members will get engaged. And if we continue to have some of these types of meetings, maybe more of them will show up and speak up around the things that Anstris is talking about. I don't know that we as the EAC should be driving that,
right?
But I would hope that it occurs.
Agreed. And Anstris, just because it's not specifically the purview of the EAC, it is very important, and we know you'll keep pushing on that issue. So thank you. All right. If anybody has anything else to say about English Station, we can always communicate about this in the future, and we'll keep an eye on it, and we can ask United Illuminating to hold another information meeting as soon as May 19th comes and the governor gives us permission to meet, especially if we could have it outside somewhere, because I don't know about the rest of you, but I am not going into a windowless room in City Hall. Even though I'm vaccinated. So, okay. So let's see. The other, I want to just let you know that next month, our meeting on June the 2nd, we have a Yale professor and a nuclear scientist named Steve Lamoureux, who is one of the country, if not the world's foremost experts on nuclear energy, coming to give us some facts, because I don't know enough about nuclear energy. And I figured if I don't, even if the rest of you know more than I do, it couldn't hurt for you to listen to me get educated. So I hope that's okay with all of you. Good. And so I know I sent around a draft letter about the bottle bill to send to the New Haven CGA delegation before the meeting to the EAC members. And I know the you liked it, Kevin. Okay, good. The representatives are voting on it. Does that mean the Senate is not voting on it yet, or they already have, or what?
I believe it's a House bill, so it would start in the House and then go up to the Senate.
Okay, great. All right, so I will send that letter on behalf of all of us. Does anybody who knows a lot about that bill feel like being the contact person from the EAC? Okay, fine. I will do it. And you know, if I get any phone calls, they're coming straight to all the rest of you, because I don't know as much about this legislation as any you know, as the rest of you probably. So anyway, thank you. And the last thing I think I will mention is that tomorrow night at 6 p.m. is the CSEP meeting, which will include a public portion. Item 3 on the agenda will concern waste disposal and management. Thank you, Sal, for arranging that. And we look forward to a very lively discussion about how to be more environmentally sound with our resources. And I don't know, does anyone have anything else to, anything else urgent to report? Nope. Okay.
Did you want a list of those of us who are showing up tomorrow? I'm planning on coming tomorrow. I was trying to let you know before the meeting started, but then everybody popped onto the meeting, so I didn't. But yes, I would like to be there tomorrow.
Okay.
And I also sent the word out to Lou Birch and company. They're going to try and send somebody to the meeting.
Good.
And they've been going to community meetings and telling people to support the bottle bill. So,
Well, I don't know if you remember, but there were a lot of people CC'd on the letter we sent requesting the public discussion. And I, like Cheryl Baldwin and Lou Birch and Domingo Medina, and I sent them a notice. I sent them an email yesterday letting them know that this meeting was happening tomorrow. So, okay. Let's hope people show up. Alder DeCola, do you have anything you want us to discuss before we adjourn?
No.
Okay.
Thank you.
Oh, you know, there is one more thing. So now that we're such buddy buddies with Deep, do we write a letter specifically requesting that they inspect Wheeler Street before renewing the permit? What do you think? Should the EAC do that?
Good idea.
Yeah, I second.
Because the permit's due, it's for renewal in September. And I would prefer that we not meet in July or August if we don't have to, if that's okay with the rest of you. Yes, okay, good. All right, so I will draft a letter. I will send it around to the members and whatever. We'll get it done that way, okay? And there is a committee working on leaf blower limiting legislation. There is a committee working on bird safe building legislation, and we'll be hearing from them eventually when they are farther along in their work. So thank you all very, very much. Anybody else have anything else to report before we adjourn? Okay, at some point I will catch up with the meeting minutes, and thank you all. I really appreciate your persevering with this difficult subject of English Station. Thank you for everybody. All right.
I just wanted to say one thing. At University Towers, we have put together an alternative energy fact-finding committee, and the building is interested in, or we're looking at the feasibility of the structure of the building to consider solar wind fuel cells, which a charging station. So the committee is up and running, and we're looking at getting some solar panels on our roofs or a combination, but we will be involved in alternative energy.
Way to go.
Florestine, could you repeat which building that is?
University Towers, York Street, 100 York Street.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, especially Dawn. Thank you, Giovanni, for listening to all of this. Thank you, Dawn, for running logistics and for backing us up every time. And we apologize for taking you away from your family at dinner time. And we will see as many of you as feel like coming to tomorrow's CSEP meeting tomorrow. And the rest of you, we will see on June 2nd. Thanks again.
Thank you.